This is Christian Payne, and this is Chewing the Yak, New Orleans interview show on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. And we have a special guest today, Professor Ed Chervenak of UNO. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining us. And for those of you who live here, you know Dr. Chervenak from seeing him every election night. He's usually on one of the TV stations and giving his expert commentary on local politics generally. And he's the head of the New Orleans University of New Orleans polling. So
the director of the Survey Research Center.
Okay, well, there you go, official. And you've been. We were talking before we went on the air, and you've been here almost 2 decades now.
Yes, 17 years. I've been at the
university. So you've kind of settled into New Orleans.
I've been in New Orleans now for 26 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So where were you before?
I was working on my PhD.
Okay.
And then
I got
hired here at UNO.
Okay. And your lovely wife is also an academic, Ella.
Yes.
And she's at Tulane, is that right?
Well, she works at focus group testing now.
Okay. All right. And she's... So we have two... an academic family here, so... Well, Ed was nice enough to join us today on Chewing the Yak, so we're going to kind of delve into a little bit potpourri of New Orleans politics and see what we can come up with here. You were in other places. You were in California. You grew up in Cleveland, so you've seen other political systems at work. I mean, you know, and how would you say, if any, does New Orleans say, and we're talking about, you know, city government, basically, and maybe state government as well in Louisiana, how... things are different, if they are different in any way.
Well, certainly New Orleans is unique, you know, as a city and as a government. Those of us who tend to travel, go somewhere else, we see that things tend to work better, function better, whether it be in Cleveland, whether it be in Los Angeles. And that government here and politics seems to be more entertainment than we find in a lot of other places. That New Orleans is a small, big city. Everyone seems to know who everyone else is.
Right.
We pay close attention to who our political leaders are. They tend to be folks just like us. And so we seem to be much more engaged in politics here than, say, we would in other big cities.
It's more personal, you think?
Yeah, I think it is much more personal.
Yeah.
You know, if Mayor Cantrell... when, you know, was out walking on the street, everyone would probably just go up and greet her just as like she was one of their neighbors.
Right. If you were in L.A., they would shoot you.
Well, I don't know if they would shoot you. They may not even know you.
Okay. I ran into Ray Nagin once on Canal Street, for instance, to prove your point. And I had been in the Gridiron Show, and he was our headliner of the year. And I made fun of him. And it was about 6 months before. But I just wanted to tell him hello because at that time he was popular. And this is before Katrina, and he told me that he remembered me, and he complimented me. He said, "I like your work, which is cool, you know." And in fact, his wife actually, they came up to me after the show and they complimented me as well. I mean, I made fun of the other people in the race as well, but and that's when Ray was cool in those days.
Yes.
So, but he did have bodyguards.
Yes. No, the mayor walks around the city with bodyguards.
Yeah, and they. But I went up to him and I could actually just shook his hand and everything, so it wasn't as if they didn't think I was a threat, but it was kind of jarring in a sense. I don't talk to people with bodyguards too often, you know, and you don't know what you're supposed to do, you know.
They're elected officials. You know, if I was to run into LaToya Cantrell, I would call her Madam Mayor. Just as a matter of respect for the office.
Absolutely. I was in Santa Fe for a brief time about almost 10 years ago now. I had a artist residency out there for a couple of months, and I needed to go to use the facilities, and I was walking the streets, and City Hall was right there, so I said, well, they must have a bathroom at City Hall. So I went in, and I walked out, and there was like an office just like this, and the mayor was like sitting right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could walk right in, and, you know,
yes.
I thought that was kind of peculiar.
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's the notion of, you know, democracy, that these are citizen legislators. So they're just like you and I.
Well, sure, but he didn't have a bodyguard. I mean, you know, there was nothing. It was just him in the door.
Him in the door.
I don't think that would happen in New Orleans.
Or any other major urban center either.
You wouldn't get that close.
Right.
But getting back to how it's personal, and we kind of have a personal relationship, what we think we do, perhaps, with some of the people. And of course, in some cases, you know, we know these people if we grew up here. Does that make it more difficult to hold them to task in some sense, you think?
Oh, no. We do hold these individuals to task. We're happy when they're doing a good job, but we can certainly turn on them if we feel they're not doing a very good job. You mentioned Ray Nagin, certainly very popular in the city. But once things did not go well, that people's opinion of him changed radically.
Right, so, but that was kind of a cataclysmic event that didn't go well as well, though.
Well, even, you know, you can look at other mayors. You know, you look at Sidney Bartholomew, who started out very well. And, of course, his numbers went down as a result of the lack of performance of his administration. So we do hold these individuals accountable for their performance.
Well, jog my memory, is Sidney playing poker with Amelia Earhart right now?
I don't think so.
Because, you know, because he's one of the guys that you never really hear much about, even though he's an ex-mayor.
Right.
He kind of, like, disappeared from the public view.
As most ex-mayors do, there's not a really strong afterlife for ex-mayors in the city.
Well, I mean, Morial's pretty prominent. I mean, not here.
Well, he's the exception.
He's you know, Ert and Ray's still on our minds. He's,
right.
Unfortunately for him, I guess.
And Mitch is traveling around the country.
Yeah,
You know, teaching at Harvard. I think he's doing some work in Palo Alto and Stanford.
But I think
as well.
Sidney was particularly kind of like conspicuous by his absence from the public scene, though. I think, I mean, in my opinion, I mean, I don't think he really didn't. In other words, I think that Landrieu probably, Morial is the urban guy,
mm-hmm.
and at some point Mitch will reappear in our lives. Sidney just doesn't seem to be, you know, in where we can see what he's doing.
That's true. And Mitch will probably appear more likely in the national scene.
Than
certainly locally.
And
because once you've been mayor, you have no place to go but down.
Well, in the city, sure.
Yes.
And I think Coolidge is the only mayor who became president, huh? He was vice president first, but I mean, he was a mayor. I think is how he got to be vice president. He was
vice president,
the mayor of
right.
Boston, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, it was like there was no time when the police could strike against the public good, something like that. I think that was Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
I think, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, because that was a different era. Now it's any time you do anything you want. I mean, somebody was asking me at a party yesterday, why hasn't anybody in the social water board gone to jail?
And you don't go to jail, you know, for being incompetent.
Okay, well, that's what I thought, too. That's what I thought. But no one's actually died. And that was if a dam broke, you know, and people would have drowned, then maybe so.
I mean, we certainly saw that with Katrina. We tried to hold the Army Corps of Engineers responsible,
right.
You know, for the damage of the city and for the loss of life. And government entities are very, very difficult to sue, as we know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I said, you don't go to jail for being incompetent. No one's stolen any money that we know of.
Right. Well, except for a few people that stole the brass fittings.
Right, right. Yeah. Who, in fact, were charged with crimes. So incompetence will not get you in prison. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens with the Sewage and Water Board. But, you know, you would think that someone needs to be held accountable. It's going to be the mayor and it's going to be the city council.
Well, it seems like, I mean, I think that, but now we have a new city council, not all of them, but several of them, and the mayor is kind of off whatever he's doing. So I don't know. You know,
but they've
know.
Made that a priority. One of the priorities that they have to deal with is the sewage and water.
Well,
with
the present city council.
Yes.
But I mean, as far as any being held accountable, I mean, the people who did it or who were in charge of it. I mean, it seems to me that during this whole debacle, I mean, Landrieu kind of stayed above it quite a bit, considering he was the head of it and the buck stops here and all that stuff. All that. You know, like you know, it's like I take full responsibility. Okay, let's have lunch. You know, I mean, not him, not everyone,
right.
All of them.
Right.
You know.
Certainly it will probably be a stain on his legacy, even though overall he has a fairly positive legacy. He went out with a pretty high approval rating.
Yeah.
You know, getting City Hall in order and getting the budget in order and you know, things of that nature. Certainly he would probably like to have done more with Sewage and Water Board. But I, you know, a lot of this I put at the feet of term limits.
Mm-hmm.
That once an individual is term limited,
doesn't care.
It's not that they don't care. It's just human nature to say, okay, I'll just deal
with
that
later. Not their responsibility,
right? And just let me get through this, and then, you know, they're a year out, and they begin thinking about other things rather than their responsibility. So, I'm not a big fan of term limits. I think that people should be able to vote who they want to vote for. I think it's a violation of voting rights.
Yeah.
And that once these individuals are term limited, I think it's just human nature for them to begin to focus on other things rather than on what they're responsible for.
Well, I mean,
because they're no longer accountable to voters.
Right, I understand. Well, I mean, I am for term limits, but I mean, I see your point, certainly. But and the thing is that the flip side of that is, I mean, there's no perfection, there's no right answer either to term limits or not having them, because then you end up with people who end up being like potentates in some cases, because name recognition, incumbency has a lot of power at the polls. I'm sure you know better than me.
Yes.
So, like, you know, you get these guys like these rural sheriffs who have been there for 46 years. I mean, it's like, you know, if Mother Teresa was in charge of something for 40 years, it would be a bad thing.
No, I know, I understand, because then you become a power upon yourself and become non-accountable. And that you begin to think that whatever you do is the right thing, and that whatever you do is it's in the public's interest.
Right, but your point is well taken. I mean, in other words, if you were there for 8 years and you're in your seventh year, you said, well, I mean, you know, I'll try to do something about it, but it's not really important to me.
Well, it's not just that. It's just human nature to become distracted about thinking about the future. Yeah. I've got another year. I'm not accountable to the voters. You know, we'll put that decision off for another day.
Yeah. Well, you know, this may be a little bit of a jump, but I was thinking we should have we need jobs in New Orleans. We should have like maybe Doug Allen could do this. They can have like a curriculum in failure, how to be a success. You know, because Cedric Grant was the head of the Sewage and Water Board. He said, well, I'll just quit and I'll get a giant pension. And Joe Becker was the assistant or whatever, the deputy director. He said, well, I'll just quit too now and I'll get a big pension. And, Marlon Gussman, he didn't even have to quit. He doesn't have to do anything. He has no power, but he still gets paid.
Yes.
Okay. You know, and of course there's Mike Ditka. Okay, which it's not political, but he got fired. He gets paid like $6 million not to coach. So I mean, so there's a lot of money in failure.
Yes, there is.
You know, so maybe there should be like a curriculum for that. I don't know. You know,
you'll have to talk to the business school about.
Yeah. And I have another theory, and since you're a professional, maybe you can help me with this one. I was telling some friends of mine. See, I don't really worry about this politics that much. I keep track of it, you know, because I make fun of it and stuff. But it's like I don't let it keep me up late at night, you know.
Right.
Because there's not much I can really do about it. I'm only one person, you know. It's like it's not my fault, okay? I mean, it's not my personal fault. I mean, I need to, you know, I try to obey the law and do my functions and everything. But I have a friend who ran for office a couple of times and extremely unsuccessfully. And I told him, I said, you know. What you should do next, if you want to run again, is you should run for the New Orleans School Board. Because did you notice that once they don't have control of the schools anymore, nobody really runs for the school board as a stepping stone anymore, hardly much, because there's no money to be made, because there's no contracts. And as soon as they get the schools back, then all these people come out the woodwork, you know, because that's kind of a stepping stone to, you know, of elected official. But now it doesn't seem so popular all of a sudden, because...
Well, it used to be, a patronage position.
Yeah,
you know, they had lots of jobs to hand out and contracts. Now with the charter schools, they're all individually run by these governing boards, and it's basically the school board just kind of sets the overall general policy of, you know, curriculum,
of education, and
right?
Stuff.
But they're not involved in the.
Well, yeah. So my theory is pretty much correct.
Yeah,
that's kind of sad and telling, don't you think?
But still. It is a good stepping stone, I think, because you do get out there, even though you're running in the district, you at least get out there and you get the meet and greet and you get to know voters.
Well, absolutely. If you're inclined to do that,
yes.
I think that's the spot to go. But still, from the other side, from a citizen, let's just say, let's just call myself a citizen. You know, if that's the case where, you know, if there's nothing to be made, you know, like contract wise and patronage wise, nobody wants it anymore. I mean, that's kind of a commentary on the situation.
Well, I mean, you get involved because you want to make a difference. You know,
well, that's the theory,
right? I mean, and certainly, there's still an element of prestige and power and policy that comes with that position. And so, there's never going to be a lack of people who want to run for these offices. But you know, the point is that if you have aspirations for the future, the school board's probably a good place to start.
At this point, yes. But my point is that it's the corruption point. We've had several school board people go to prison over the years.
Yes.
And I don't know whether that's a norm around the country. That's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. We can try to see if we can settle into some kind of a norm. In other words, one of our school board guys that went to jail, it might not have even had anything to do with the school board. He's the coroner now.
But he did his time.
I know. Well, you know,
and that was kind of an odd situation. The way he got into office was, you know,
because the other guy dropped out.
Right.
But that doesn't really
So who knows what would happen if we would have the election, whether you would have the
right. But that's not a good visual either, though.
Right.
I mean that. I mean, how often does that happen around the country?
It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
You know, usually when you qualify, you're gonna
complete
it and run for that office. So it's rare where someone qualifies and then decides, well, I'm going to get out
at the last minute, so nobody else can run.
Right. So no one else can get on the ballot.
I mean, not that it's on tour. I mean, like, I don't know if you. I can't remember how long ago it was now when Lawrence Gihardi the Elder was the assessor. You know, and he was like, he could run forever and he would win forever.
Right.
And like, you know, 5 minutes before or whatever, he decided not to run. But he didn't tell anybody, and his son came in and qualified.
So, yeah, I mean, no, I remember that. So that's manipulating the system.
Absolutely. So I mean, that's kind of, you know, I don't know what can be done about that.
You know, sometimes if you know the rules, you can bend the rules.
Sure, of course.
So, you know, and that was more of an effort at self-interest.
Whereas I mean, he probably
Jeffrey Rouse decided to get out, you know, it wasn't about him, per se. He was just like, okay, I just want to focus on the psychiatric side of this, as opposed to the administrative side of being the coroner.
Coroner, yeah. Well, I mean, my theory is, I mean, I'm on the outside looking at totally amateurs. He probably figured once he got in it, he said, man, this is not for me.
Right.
I mean, that's the end of that.
But that would be okay, but then he could have said...
but not like that.
Right. Then he could have said, I'm not going to run for re-election.
Right.
And then a lot of people would have probably qualified.
Right. Well, I have a couple of other little things here about the local politics. But let's talk about, if you don't mind, about the governor's race coming up, which is starting to, you know, so basically... right now we just have three relatively major candidates, I guess. Edwards,
the incumbent,
and Congressman Abraham, and this Rispone, I think his name is.
Yeah, Edward Rispone.
He's a businessman.
Right.
Now, I mean, the qualifying isn't even close, right?
No.
So, I mean, so lots of other people could get in. I mean, I understand that you have to build... you know, campaign, all that kind of stuff. But somebody with money or with name recognition could kind of get in at the last minute, couldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things about campaigns today and candidates is that they're self-starters.
Yes.
And that...
that's a problem as well, I think.
Well, it used to be, you know, the parties would decide who would be running, the Republican would decide who would be challenging that John Bel Edwards, and the Democratic Party would be backing him. But with, you know, this weakening of the party organizations over time... these individuals decide they're going to run. They're self-starters. They basically decide for themselves they're going to run. They raise their own money. They build their own organization. And then if they're successful in the primary, then the party will come in. And back them.
I've had that discussion many times around in ballrooms about how we seem to think that we got better candidates when it was in a smoke-filled room, because there had to be some kind of consensus.
Yes.
Across a broad spectrum of, you know, interest. Whereas now it's just guys sitting around says, well, I got plenty of money, I know somebody, or I'm somebody, so I'll decide to run.
That's right.
I pick myself.
So at one time, party officials would judge the fitness of candidates and decide whether they would, you know, back them financially and with other resources. Today, it's just a free-for-all.
Right. Well, one of the other things about politics as well, which is kind of like a dogma, is that, you know, like money rules. And I'm sure that is true to some extent, but it's not necessarily a... all-encompassing thing. It doesn't work all the time.
No.
I mean, I'm sure you know Malcolm Gladwell and somewhat. His books talked about that, about how it's not true necessarily. Okay. I mean, not to pick on anybody, but John Georges is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he spent beaucoup. Okay, and he won like one parish, I think, when he ran for governor.
You know, you could look at someone like Jeb Bush, who spent hundreds of millions of dollars
basically
just flamed out in the primary.
Right.
So money is no guarantee. It certainly helps.
Absolutely. If you have none, then you're probably not going to win.
Right.
Okay, but because you have plenty doesn't mean you're going to get it.
That's correct.
You know, and...
so it's not a guarantee. It's not a...
Right.
It's certainly not... There's no one-to-one relationship on the number of dollars you spent, the number of votes that you get.
How important do you think name recognition is? I mean, just...
It's extremely important.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Is one of the things that benefits, say, our congressional delegation. Is that everyone, they don't remember their names, but they recognize the names, right?
Yeah.
You know, they'll see the name on the billboard.
Right.
And then once they walk into the voting booth, oh, I recognize that name. And so name recognition is really key. And so this is what gives, I think, John Bel Edwards the advantage in the governor's race, is that his two opponents now, they first have to work on name recognition. So they're going to have to expend resources just to get their name out and get people to recognize it. Then... all right, talk about their platform, what they want to do. right? Whereas John Bell Edwards goes in automatically with name recognition.
Sure.
And then he can just devote, all right, this is my program, this is what I want to do.
Well, I think that he's in a pretty decent position because he's going to get, if he's running against Republicans, he's going to get a large share of the Democratic vote right away, even though this is a Republican state.
Yeah.
But he's definitely a conservative Democrat. I mean, from a national perspective.
Yes.
He's an Army, veteran and stuff like that.
Socially conservative.
Rural,
right.
So I think he's got a good shot to win for both of those reasons. Plus the two guys he's running against, like you just said, not everybody knows who they are at this point. I mean, they will eventually, I assume.
And the other thing that Republicans have to worry about is if other Republicans get in, then they start splitting up.
Right. That's what I was going to make.
There's kind of like a circular firing squad.
But at the same point, say if one of them kind of drops out, let's say 3 months to go, and there's only two, then that might be a problem for him.
Yes. Well, it depends on the strength of the candidate.
It depends, right. And the other one probably wouldn't drop out unless the one that dropped out was horribly weak and felt he had no chance. So that might say that the other guy is getting a little momentum. But
it would probably, some party official would have to just convince one of these individuals, look, this is just...
not the thing to do.
Right, then not the thing to do. Look, we'll support you on a subsequent race or, candidacy or something like that, but this is not your time.
So you mean like when Karen Carter Pearson tried to tell John Bell it was not their run?
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't listen.
Yeah, they don't listen, yeah.
They all believe that they can win,
just
with the right connections, the right message. I can win this race.
Yeah, that reminds me of something. That reminds me of, I know this is a kind of a scattershot interview here, but I really appreciate, we're at WAMF, this is Shoe in the Act, this is Chris Champagne with Professor Ed Chervenak of UNO, and Nate, the group you're with again that you're head of,
The Survey Research Center.
Okay, because I want to make sure you get that in. And it's kind enough to spend some time with us talking about New Orleans and Louisiana politics. In your experience, how important, I guess, are debates?
I think debates are important. It gives voters a chance to see the two candidates on a one-on-one, or I don't know, at least at a minimum on a one-on-one basis, and see how they handle the pressure of the debate. Can they basically present themselves well? Because image is also important. We've talked about money, but image is extremely important in politics as well. And so, projecting that positive image during a debate. Being calm, cool, collected, being able to answer the questions, being able to withstand, any of the pressure, and of course, not make any major mistakes.
Right. Well, I think that our political process has deteriorated somewhat since I was a kid. I mean, I think it's for a variety of reasons. I think it's extremely more partisan, especially right now, than it has been for some reason. It kind of creeped up on us at some point, maybe. But the debate situation, I mean, I guess it kind of started with television, really, and Nixon and Kennedy. I mean, obviously, the Lincoln, Douglas debates were a long time ago, and that used to be more part of our culture as well, where people would get on this stuff, and people would throw and people would go to see them. But then it would have to be reported by the newspaper, of course, which was everybody read, generally. But, so my question, not my question, but maybe just an observation, is that it's interesting to me that it's become like a staple or kind of a thing where you almost have to debate. I mean, you don't always have to. If you're really way ahead, you kind of try to stay away from it. Maybe you just have one. But it seems to be something that people expect now.
Yes.
So that's kind of a good thing, I think. At least for what you said, you get to measure the person yourself to some degree.
Yes. At least through the medium of television.
Right. When I was asking the question, I almost felt stupid because obviously we just had an example in Jefferson Parish of debates.
Yes.
I mean, that guy. I mean, I played football with that guy, the loser.
John Fortunato.
A long time ago, in Nord. He doesn't remember, I'm sure. Taylor Park. But I mean, he blew it. I mean, he just did.
That's a lot of people. A lot of people have said is that his failure to condemn Mike Yenny in that debate cost him a lot of votes. And that tended to show up on the polls that we did.
I'm pretty sure that was just not the right thing to say.
Not at that particular point.
Right.
He could have just said, I don't want to, that's a hypothetical.
Sure.
I don't want to answer that question.
Well, it seems to me.
And so that it's kind of like, are people quick enough on their feet? And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for.
Right. I would say you're right in general about being quick on your feet, but I have to say, if you or me or anybody who might pass by happened to be his campaign manager, they had to know they were going to ask that question. or something like that, don't you think?
You would think you would have your candidate prepared
for that one,
right? I don't know if they knew. I doubt if they knew what questions were coming.
Well, they probably didn't know the questions, but I mean, come on, that's been kind of like them. I mean, there aren't.
But certainly, Mike Enny's been a focus of Jefferson Parish politics, and you probably would be asked a question about him.
I mean, there's not a lot of issues in Jefferson Parish that galvanize the entire parish. I mean, it almost runs itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least it appears to.
Right.
So that was kind of like one of the go-to thing issue for a long time. So you kind of had to know something had to come up. I mean, you just had to. I mean, not the exact question, certainly.
Right.
But I mean, and talking about name recognition, I'm gonna run for office. I'm gonna change my name to Obama, Trump, Lincoln, Kennedy, Tiger Woods, or something like that. Okay, and I'll run for mayor of New Orleans. Okay, and I'll win. But I tell you that, and that, I don't know if you were here. I hate to keep saying that, but Sidney Bartholomew had a debate with Donald Mintz on television,
mm-hmm.
and man, it was brutal. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, that was the worst performance I've ever. I mean, Dan Quayle looked like a statesman compared to Sidney in that debate. It was terrible. But I mean, he wiped the floor with him, and of course, he won anyway.
Right, debates are not determinative.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw Mitt Romney eat Obama's lunch in that very first debate.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And so, just because you don't do well in the debate doesn't mean you're going to lose the election.
Sure.
But certainly, it called it. Caused a lot of people to scratch their head and go, where was Obama? Where was he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Reagan had that because I mean Reagan was older, so maybe that was a problem with him. But he had that first debate with Mondale where he didn't do well, and he had that joke that kind of brought it back.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's just for some reason presidents just don't do very well in their first debate because they're not used to being challenged.
Well, that could be so. Yeah.
Right. They're just not used to being challenged.
But obviously, I mean, there's danger there.
Yes.
If you're ahead.
Yes. There's danger if you're ahead, and there's also the danger of not debating and being accused of, being scared or, not wanting to stand up there and debate your opponent.
Right, but there are certainly times when you're so far ahead.
Yes.
That it's probably wise to take that blow.
Yes,
and not go out there.
Yes, you don't want to give equal standing to your opponent if you're that far ahead.
Yeah.
That's what basically debates do. Is you now
you
have these two or three or four individuals or how many, and they're all there on the same stage, and now they all have equal standing.
Now this is not a political question necessarily, but when we do have some kind of malfeasance or some kind of problem in government or at least the government. Entity or with the public, like the library thing with Mayfield and Foreman or whatever, it certainly takes them a long time, doesn't it, to come to a conclusion.
Well, first you got to do the investigation, and it seems like we do have a much more aggressive investigative media today than we did prior to Katrina.
Yeah.
And so you got to gather up all the data, and then of course, then it's up to the. Whether it's the district attorney or whether it's the attorney general to decide whether they feel there's any malfeasance there,
sure.
Then those people have to be charged. Then you have to go through the criminal justice process, and that's just a slow-moving process.
Yeah, I understand that, it shouldn't be like, we shouldn't find out about it on Wednesday and adjudicate it on Friday, because that wouldn't be fair to anybody, really.
Right.
But it just seems to take a long process sometimes when it comes to these public... I guess they want to get everything... They don't want to lose, I guess, is what
right.
it amounts to.
And, you always have... of course, you hire the best defense lawyers who are able to, bring about these continuations and things like that. And I mean, I'm a lawyer... So I can't speak to the legal process
per se,
but you have the process of discovery. We need this witness. All right, we need that witness. We need this document. Things of that nature. So it's just a slow moving process. But we've seen eventually they'll get there.
Yeah. Listen to WAMF FM New Orleans 90.3 on your radio dial. One of the things that bothers me about what happens in public life when it gets into the judicial system is that, and not just politics, just with crime in general, it doesn't seem like this used to be the case so much as it is now. And when I say this used to be, I mean, I'm talking about, 30 years ago or more, they seem to deal more. as opposed to go to trial?
Only about 10% of cases go to trial. 90%.
Yeah, so there's lots of dealing.
Yes. So yeah. Most 90% are plea bargains.
Yeah, so it seems like it's like a coupon for crime. I mean, you got that. I mean, I know you don't think of that when you're perpetrating a crime, but I mean, it's like, you know, you did all these things and you're only going to get called on for 2%. I mean, that just
right.
doesn't seem...
As long as it's not a revolving door and they're just going in and then pleading out and going getting back on the street, I think. Because if everything did go to trial, it would just be gridlock.
Well, sure.
We wouldn't get any justice.
Well, that's what someone asked me about. When they asked me about the sewage and water board thing the other night, I said, well, the reason that they haven't done anything is because it would break, they'd go broke feeding them all. Okay, so they can't afford to put them all in jail. Okay.
And then only that, we've got this, you know, criminal justice reform movement going on, and we're trying to reduce the number of people who are incarcerated.
Yeah, everything's okay. Yeah, everything's not so bad. So it didn't happen to me.
Well, it's just the fact that we're not going to jail ourselves out of dealing with crime. We've got more people in prison today than ever.
Well, right, but they don't have them in for the right thing. So
right,
they have too many people in for. You know, violent crimes or, say, malfeasance in office, I think they should be more people in jail.
Right.
Okay, and less people for, drugs or whatever, depending on if it's a low-level thing.
Right.
So, I mean, but they seem to try to do something, let's say, but they don't seem to get it right, when they do it. I mean, they don't get it totally wrong, but they just seem to go overboard in one way to try to, I don't know. I mean, like this new city council, I mean, they're almost like, and the last one, too, as far as that goes, I think they've changed quite a bit since the new council seems to have been a substantial change, at least from looking outside looking in. But it's almost like a pull-it bureau, you know what I mean? They're going to stop you from smoking, they're going to stop you from doing this, they're going to stop you from doing that, you know? And, not that I'm against some of those things,
mm-hmm.
but it just seems a little bit, draconian to me that they can change things so quickly.
We'll get to your point that sometimes they don't get it right. You know, one of the things about democracy is that it's, don't look for neat, clean politics
sure.
or policy, because it's a messy system. And so, the best policy is the one that can get the votes that will get passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not necessarily the most cleanest, purest policy that would actually work.
Sure.
So
yeah, well,
I think a lot of people just, fail to understand that democracy is just, it's a very complicated, messy system.
Right.
And everyone wants to get their opinion in there, and they'd like to see this priority established and that. And out of this polyglot, we get some sort of policy.
Well, no, it goes
and
back to...
It may not be the neatest, cleanest policy.
Sure. Well, it goes back to what you said before, it's human nature as well, because you've got all these... Everybody has their own interests.
Yes.
That are coming to bear, and it's hard to make everybody happy.
That's right.
You know, so, I mean, look, I'm critical of everything. It's just my nature, But in the same token, I mean, you look at other countries, how their things sift out there politically. I mean, listen, we're way ahead as far as I'm concerned. I don't think any place really does anything that I can tell. Maybe some places in Europe, do it. But maybe not. I don't know. So I'm okay with our system. If I had to swap it for somebody else's,
right.
Okay.
Yes, because our system is best protects liberty.
But I would.
It's much easier to get things done.
Yeah.
In other political systems, because you don't have the divided government.
Right.
Like we do here. But at the same time, it's much easier to infringe on people's liberties there than it is here.
Sure. I mean, if we had Pharaoh, we'd have nicer statues and stuff. Maybe the streets would be clean, but but that's okay.
Yes,
that's
the trade-off.
So that's right. But I understand that, but I do think that we're kind of getting away from some of the things when I was a kid, it just seemed I'm sure that there were a lot of things that were more corrupt because there wasn't as much transparency.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I mean, I think that I think New Orleans functioned better. When I was a kid, we didn't have these floods when it rained, and that may have something to do with the construction of all the construction and stuff. I don't know; it probably does, but I don't remember any floods. That was a hurricane, maybe, but not for rains.
Right. But at that time, the equipment was newer, right?
Well, the equipment was still about 80 years old. Okay, then.
Now
okay.
It's over 100 years old.
Yeah, I know, but that equipment. Okay, should get an award. Okay, that's some of the best equipment ever created by humans. I mean, regardless. I mean, if it's still working, it never broke like in 100 years, some of it. Still hasn't, really.
It's not that it's not broken, it's that they continue to kind of patchwork fix
it. Perhaps, but I mean, that I don't think it's the equipment's fault. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I don't. Okay, it's like Miss Cantrell's one of her interim humans. Okay, that gave somebody gave raises to the people who failed, and it was, I don't think it's there anymore.
Right.
She said about the software problem that they inherited from the Landrieu administration, that the billing software that didn't work correctly. She said it wasn't a software problem. It was a people problem.
Right.
Bingo. Okay. So I mean, that would be my guess. So I don't think it's the equipment. I mean, I don't. I mean, it is old now. Okay. But so am I. Okay.
And we're still functioning.
And I'm still functioning. Okay. At least until tomorrow. Now, let's go on a little lighter note, if you don't mind. I'm writing a book about the NFL right now. And I'm trying to find quirky things that happen or interesting things that happen in each franchise's history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've run across a couple of political things, and I just wanted to see. I wanted to ask you if you were aware of one of them. Because I found it out the other day, because I don't live in that place, and I thought it was kind of interesting. There was a mayor of Pittsburgh named Ravenstahl, and they had a playoff game coming up with the Baltimore Ravens.
Mm-hmm.
So he went down to City Hall and he had his name changed to Steelestahl. Now he didn't fill out he didn't pay the fee or something. So he did it. So it was kind of like a stunt. So they didn't do it. Were you aware of that one?
No, but that's a good story.
That's a nice story, though. I thought it was an interesting story. Now the other one, one of the teams that I've done a lot of stuff on was the Baltimore Indianapolis Colts, and that's a famous story where they moved the team out overnight. And if you don't know a lot about that story, there was a lot of political machinations in there. And the reason that they moved the team was because the Baltimore legislature had passed a law, that ordinance, that they were going to create eminent domain. They were going to take the team away from them.
Mm-hmm.
So when they passed that, they called the moving vans that night and got out of there. And, of course, they said later, the mayor said he never was going to do that. But, I mean, you know, that's kind of...
Coming from...
Cleveland.
The Ursay, and also, you know, given the history of the Ursay family as the owners of the Colts, I'm not sure that they can be totally trusted in you know, certainly their side of the story.
Right. I'm sure there's two sides to the story.
Yeah.
But the
Ursays don't have the best reputation in the NFL.
Well, that's probably true. But I think that I've done a lot of research on it, and I think that they did get a little bit of a bad rap, though, because they were going to take the team,
mm-hmm.
you know, by law. Now, of course, they probably wouldn't have gotten away with that, I don't think. But maybe,
it's kind of like to mirror the Green Bay Packers, where they're owned by the community.
Right, but they don't allow them to do that anymore. The bylaws of the NFL don't allow them to do. But also that stadium issue was actually predated Ursay. In other words, that's why Carol Rosenblum got out of there.
Right.
Because they had been trying to get a stadium since the early 50s. In fact, it was either Ursay or Rosenblum made a deal. They said
they swapped.
In fact, that was a pretty slick deal because they didn't have to pay taxes. And from what I understand, they still teach that technique in law schools around the country now.
Mm-hmm.
Rosenblum doing it. Rosenblum was quite a character. I mean, you could almost do a movie about his life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way it panned out. And as I was looking through all of these, you know, political machinations about that, it came to mind certainly that basically we got the Saints through political pressure.
Yes.
So it's
well, you know, particularly with the stadiums. You know, with public subsidies, I mean, that's going to make it a political hot potato.
Sure, sure.
You know, we've been actually pretty fortunate here in New Orleans. The Superdome's lasted much longer than probably anyone ever anticipated,
right.
Whereas we've seen in other cities,
right.
These owners, you know, start yelling and screaming and threatening to move the franchise if they don't get these public subsidies to build these new stadiums, where then... Of course, then they're getting all the revenue from parking, from concessions, and so this is what makes it so political.
Right. It's a real contentious issue, but I mean, it's kind of like they've got you over a barrel in a sense in the NFL.
The only city that's been able to get away with this, in fact, is Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
That they had not able to threaten Los Angeles with, say, oh, you know, if you don't give us a stadium, we're not going to bring a franchise. And they're like, our economy is so big and so diverse. right? That it's
yeah,
just
we don't care.
We don't really care.
Yeah. Well, I got the guy to come in, it's Kroenke, so he's paying for it.
He's paying for it. The state basically said, we're not going to subsidize
it. And because of those reasons, because he thinks it's a good deal for him, because he's because that's such a big economy.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I was in L.A., I was driving, a friend of mine moved back here, and he had a Z that he was borrowing back from his friend, and he couldn't go get it, so he asked me to go drive it back. So it was a Sunday, and the Saints were playing the Los Angeles Rams at that time. And I could not find the Los Angeles Rams on the radio. I mean, I couldn't find the game.
Hmm.
I mean, I was in California. I found seven stations with the Dodgers, and not one with the Rams. So that goes to show you how they cared about the Rams,
right?
You know?
Right. No,
you know
it's
mean?
True.
You know?
When they lost those franchises, they didn't blink an eye.
Yeah.
That they thought. And in fact, when I was there, you could. They were playing every game on television because there were no blackouts.
Yeah.
So you could watch basically almost every game, you know, on the NFL. And so they were not concerned about.
Yeah.
Being blackmailed from those stadiums.
And now they've got two teams. They've got one playing at a soccer stadium.
Right.
And that one's in the playoffs.
Yes.
Both of them are
in the playoffs.
Yeah, both of them are in the playoffs. But the one that's playing at a soccer stadium's in the playoffs, which I think is kind of interesting. Well, you know, Benson wanted a new stadium here.
Right.
For a while. And then they kind of, I guess the politicians kind of talked to him out of it, but, you know, Katrina and all that kind of stuff. He had to kind of rehabilitate his image after Katrina.
Yes. Well, they've done plenty of renovations on it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a first-class facility.
Well, I mean, listen, it used to be the greatest stadium in the world.
Right.
And they built it, you know. And, of course, certainly is it now, but still, I was there last night. I went to the Sugar Bowl, and it's a nice stadium. You know,
mm-hmm.
It still holds up well. I mean, considering after all this time, you know. I mean, I guess it's inevitable. I mean, plus it's like the location is like is perfection, really,
right.
For the city for about a variety of reasons. So that was one thing politicians did. I'm not a giant fan of Mr. McKithen, but he's the one that got it done. So at least he got that done. So that's almost going back to the Pharaoh times, you know, where they could do such things, you know. And
they could ram it through. They could make the deals and ram it through the legislature.
That's right. So they could, you know. So there's a plus side to that, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some sense, to the greater good, or at least a greater good than some. And then, you know, I don't know if I want to get too much in specifics, but it's like when you does the name Rufus Johnson ring a bell?
It does not.
Okay. Well, he ran for office actually, and. You can go to people's houses in New Orleans still, and they'll have one of his posters up on their walls, because on his posters, I think he was running for judge, and it said on his posters, it said that he has the favor of God. So it got to be kind of like a little bit of a small cult of people who put it on their walls if they could get one. Well, he was a bail bondsman,
mm-hmm.
and it came out a couple of years ago that he didn't have a bail bond license, so he'd been issuing bail bonds for like 21 years across the street from the court office. And it came out that the clerk of courts and Mr. Morrell's minions
mm-hmm.
were like forging judges' names for 21 years. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. And then when he went to trial, okay, he had Buddy Lemon, who's a prominent attorney, as his attorney, and Buddy Lemon told the judge that his client was crazy, evidently, because they had a deal. Well, he would only go to jail for like 2 years, and he'd already been in jail for a year. But he didn't want to give the deal because God told him not to take it, so he got 20 years instead.
Oh my goodness!
But the part that I mean, it's really a particularly wonderful story. But the part about the clerk of court employees forging the judge's names, and when they asked Morrell about it, he said everything's working fine.
That's Arthur's motto. Everything is fine.
Well, everything isn't fine, though, right?
That's true.
At least then.
But anytime you talk to Arthur Morrell, everything's good, everything's great, everything's fine.
Well, sure, he's, you know,
right.
he could teach the, maybe he could teach the Seminar Delgado. I mean, from a different perspective.
Right.
I mean, his son seems to be a pretty impressive guy.
Yes.
You know, I've heard him on the radio, and he seems like he's, you know, I remember I did a Gridiron show, right, to the Gridiron show, and I ran into Cynthia Hedge Morrell was coming in, and I talked to her, and we were talking about how I was going to be in the show. And I told her, I said, you can relax. I said, I'm not going to say anything about you. She said, oh, thank you. You know, that was fun doing. I used to do the Gridiron show. So I did, I'm trying to think, I can't remember who the headline was the first year, but Morial was the headline on one thing. I don't think he came to the show, though.
Mm.
And Harry Lee came to the show. And I remember one the Harry Lee sketch, and he went to the bathroom during that one. So that didn't, so that was kind of a disappointment. And but Megan was cool about it. Blanco complimented me also after the show. I wasn't too hard on her, but, you know, but a little bit, you know. I think the one joke I remember about her was I did a 9/11 sketch, making fun of the people, Bush administration, different things, and Free and Janet Reno and different people, and Bush, and Bobby Mueller also, by the way, Bobby Three Sticks, who is now more prominent. And I remember when they started, right before they started the war, they sent four governors over there on a fact-finding mission before they went into Iraq, in the first war. And one of them was Blanco. And I'm thinking to myself, man, you know, I said, man, what is going on in this mind? You know, what's up? They sent Kathleen Blanco over there to find the fact. I said, what's up with that? Okay. And she was sitting there, you know. I said, I'm just glad they didn't send Mike Foster over there, because then they'd be fighting this war without helmets, because he was against it. So, you know, but so that was kind of fun. And Landrieu was the last one, I think. The last Green Island did, Landrieu was the headliner. And he was... It was at Chateau Noir, so it was a very small place. And he was sitting there with his wife and with his mother and dad, and he was in the front. And I was the only one that really made, like, any scathing fun at him. You know, so, but he was cool about it, too. But what else are you going to do? You know what I mean? I'm nobody, so it doesn't make a difference what I say. But he was nice about it. I mean, I think that, you know, I think he was a good mayor in a lot of ways by turning things back into where they should be because of what happened before and stuff. But I don't know. I think he's kind of a selfish guy as well. But I guess they wouldn't run. I guess
you know you have to have a big ego. You've got to have a lot of ambition if you want to, you know, run for that. And you have to have thick skin, because you're going to take a lot of criticism, no matter what you do, whatever decisions you make.
Right, someone's going to be unhappy.
Well, right. Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I don't mean to talk about me, but I did one of my shows right at the Katrina. And I did pretty well with it, because I guess there was nobody here. So I was the only thing, anybody doing anything. And Tom Shedler came up to me after one of my shows. And he said, maybe I should have introduced myself to Tom Shedler. He's a state senator then. And he said, it was really good. I really liked it. And I said, well, thank you. I said, well, I saw your name on the list. And I thought maybe that might be who you were, because I mean, I recognize your name. And he said, would you be interested in doing your show for the legislature? And I said, well, sure. You know, I said, as long as they pay me. And they don't get mad at me, you know. As long as I can take a joke. He says, they don't care. I said, oh, yeah. I said, what about such and such? I said, I kind of called him a whore, basically. Oh, he doesn't care. I said, okay. So he says, call me Monday. So I said, okay. So I called him, and I didn't know what they had. So I asked for a certain amount of money. He said, okay. So I went up to Baton Rouge, and there was they got lobbyists to pay for it, okay. And I went into his office, and I kind of checked things out around him. And I said, man, I can see why people run for office now. I won't go into why, but nonetheless, so I went up there, and Billy Tozian III, who's Billy Tozian's son, was a lobbyist. He ran for his position against Melanson. It was kind of a nasty race, and Melanson won. So he was there. He was one of the lobbyists. And so I talked to him for 40 minutes before the show, because he always made all this food and everything. And so at the end of it, I told him, I said, listen, I said, you know, I've enjoyed talking to you, and you're a really nice guy. He was a pretty smart kid, I thought, you know. And I said, but I just want to let you know you're in the show. What do you mean? I said, well, you're in the show. I have something about this other particular guy, and I needed somebody's name, and I just chose yours, and it's on a CD. It's on, like, audio, so I really can't change it. And I didn't want to blindside you, because I feel kind of unclean by talking to you for 40 minutes and all of a sudden saying something about you and not telling you much, you know. He said, well, you got to have a thick skin. That's what brought up when you said that, you know. And I have an audio tape of that show. And I happened to run across it, and I was listening to it. And, man, I was the best audience I ever had. And they laughed at everything, you know. And he told me after something, and told him, he said, it was okay what you said about me. He said, but, you know, he said, I had to say you were good. He said, because everybody laughed. I said, I know when people said, even when you said things they didn't agree with, you know. So that was kind of cool, you know. But you do. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you do. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why people don't run.
Right.
Because you got to have... You got to have a super thick skin,
yeah.
Because they're going to say everything possible about you. And you know, the thing is this: I mean, I have a degree in history from this university, and when they talk about how politics is nasty, man, look, 1826.
Yes.
It ain't nothing like that.
No, it was much worse.
It was much worse.
Yes, it was much more personal.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they were vicious.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So, I mean, so at least we got that going for us, I guess.
Yes, so in that sense, we've calmed down a bit. But, yeah, he's much, much more personal, much more vicious.
Right. And,
in terms of personal attacks and, attacking the individual, but attacking members of their family.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even, like today, that's off limits.
Well, you know, people often say to me, you know, when I tell them I'm a political satirist, that, you know, oh, well, you know, you're in New Orleans, Louisiana, you know, this is like it writes itself, you know. So in the same token, as a political scientist in New Orleans, I mean, it must be kind of interesting.
This is the greatest place, this is the greatest city in the world to be a political scientist, particularly someone who focuses on voters and elections and public opinion. I'm like a kid in a candy store here.
Well, good.
And so I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be a political scientist here at the University of New Orleans.
Well, you'll be listening to Chewing the Ad on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans, and we're with Professor Ed Chervenac. Well, Ed, Professor Chervenac, you're an important man in the city, and I appreciate you taking time to talk to me.
I appreciate you talking to you. I can love to do it anytime.
Well, thank you. And you're a gentleman, and you're an asset to the community.
Well, thank you very much.
You certainly are.
You are as well.
Well, I appreciate that. That was the correct thing to say. No, thank you, Ed. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Okay. Take it away, Kelsey May and Evermore Nest.
Down south in North Mississippi, they have tall, skinny trees that straddle the edges of bridges, resembling your knees. And I can't stop thinking about the choices that we made and how welcome you felt, how welcome you felt back at our old sunset to my left. I keep driving north, settled and restless. Storm beat me to it. Must have passed recently. All the trees that scattered the ground are still holding on to green leaves. And what a shame to only see the spring for just a moment before the wind rushes through. The wind rushes through, leaving you fallen and broken to. Keep driving north, settled and full of guilt. We'll be right back. Mississippi, they have tall, skinny trees that straddle the edges of bridges, resembling